If they weren't thinking about money, they were thinking, yeah, blood bank, basically, you give a bit of blood, it doesn't cost you too much, heck, you can make some more blood, and that guy who gets the blood, whoever it is, they're going to be really glad that there was blood there, because that could be a lifesaver. Of course, that's a good deal. So when you think about money, you think selfishly. So those people with the nuclear waste facility thought, well, perhaps it's got to be here somewhere, let's have it here. Once money was involved, they started to weigh up health risk. Yeah, perhaps we don't want it. So this is worrying news if we're attaching price tags to more and more things, because when people see those price tags, then they switch from a whole variety of different motivations and thought patterns to the market. What is in it for me personally? Now, the second section, relationship to pain. Now, this is a deceptively simple but effective experiment. The experimental subjects were asked to put their hand in some hot water and then rate how painful it was. And there were two groups. One group of people counted banknotes before they put their hand in the hot water. Another group of people counted plain paper, the same size as the banknotes, but without anything printed on them, it wasn't money. So they were given this task, well, while you're waiting, could you help by counting this number of pieces of paper, or could you help by counting this money? They weren't made aware that this was part of the experiment. And the remarkable thing is that the people who were counting the paper were slightly more distressed, on average, than the people who were counting the money. And you can see the graph, it's not actually very much, there's not a lot in it. So on its own, that's not terribly significant, but they had arranged for another factor to be included, which they call social exclusion. It was a rigged computer game, so in fact, it didn't involve other people, it just involved the computer, but they thought it did. And it was about passing the ball, so imagine if you're playing a game of passing the ball in a circle and nobody bothers, they skip over you, then you think, hey, what's going on here? Why didn't anybody want to play with me? And they told the experimental subjects, yeah, there are other people in the other room, the computer is mediating your playing. So the treatment was normal, which is that you get to play in turn, as you would expect, and social exclusion, which is that for reasons that you didn't know, that is, for reasons which weren't explained to the experimental subject, i.e. the game was rigged, nobody passed them the ball, so they didn't get to play. And so, compare the graph with the minor difference of counting money and counting paper with the socially excluded graph. The pain is more for people who have been exposed to this sort of fake social exclusion. Of course, they don't know it's fake. And counting money is a great anesthetic. It's much more significant than people who are just counting paper. So, to summarize that, if you've been socially excluded, you're more sensitive to pain, and especially if you've been socially excluded, counting money instead of counting paper works as a painkiller. So people actually rated significantly less pain if they'd been counting banknotes, rather than if they'd been counting equivalent pieces of paper. Another variation on this theme, before people put their hands in hot water, they did some chatting about two different topics. One was a neutral topic, i.e. the weather. One was losing money. And the people who talked about losing money rated the hot water as significantly more painful than if they'd been talking about the weather. And again, for the socially excluded, the difference is much larger. So those people who have been socially excluded are rating the pain as almost twice as high if they'd been talking about money loss compared to if they'd been talking about the weather. So if you think pain is a physical thing that depends on the temperature of the water and people's sensitivity on their hands, well, it clearly isn't just that, because it's related to what's on their mind, what they've been talking about. And talking about losing money is literally a painful topic, and especially so when people are already feeling social exclusion. So why is this? Well, a quote from the research, quote, "The mere idea of money has considerable psychological power, enough to alter reactions to social exclusion and even to physical pain." Unquote. So money is working as a kind of social painkiller. How come just touching money reduces people's pain? Well, thinking about money makes most people feel strong and independent. They're not dependent on other people because they've got plenty of money. So if they need help, they can buy it. So money effectively reduces people's natural desire for friendship, because they don't rely on their friends, they rely on their money. Does this help us understand the typical image of a miser who's counting his money? Maybe he hasn't got friends, but he's feeling secure, he's feeling comfort from his money. Does this help us understand how the super rich feel like keeping their debt on the books, keeping their paper money total increasing is more important than maintaining social relationships or even maintaining a healthy ecosystem? Now, the third section is called the dictator game. And this is actually an exception, because this is economics research. This is called behavioral economics, which is when you look at how people actually behave in the real world. It's not quite real world. You're making up this game, then people are playing it. So the dictator game is very simple. Actually, in terms of game theory, it's so simple it's not actually a game. Nominally, it involves two players, A and B. A is the dictator. B actually doesn't play an active part in the game. He just sits there. Player A, the dictator, is given a certain amount of money by the economics researcher, say $10, and his task, because he's the dictator, is to say how much he will get and how much the other player, player B, will get. Now, economic theory, considering he doesn't actually have to give any money to player B, economic theory says, look, everybody's a selfish maximizer, so player A is going to maximize his utility. He's going to get as much money as he can, i.e. all the money, so he won't give any money to player B. So that's the theory. And what about the practice? Well, that does happen, but quite often player A says, okay, well, there's two of us, we've just got some money, half each then. So the dictator, who has the power to keep all the money, a lot of the time splits it 50-50. So that's a complete paradox, according to conventional economic theory, which says everybody wants more for themselves, and they don't give a stuff about anyone else. So that's the dictator game, and that's the first step of a more complicated one called the ultimatum game, where, again, the dictator, player A, has a chance to split the money between himself and player B, but this time player B actually has a choice. He can either accept the split, okay, that's how much money we've got, or he can say, no, let's just give it all back to the experimenter. We neither of us get anything. So, how would you play that game if you're the dictator? Would you split it 50-50? Remember, you can take as much money as you want. Would you take all the money? Would you maybe take 90% of the money, take $9, and give the other guy one? Well, it's up to him whether anybody gets any money. If he wants, he can say, well, I'm not happy, we'll cancel that. Nobody gets any. Well, economic theory, remember, predicts everybody's a selfish maximizer. Everybody's rational. So the second player, because the choice is either to get whatever he's allocated by the dictator, or to get nothing. Well, nothing is the lowest possible result. So economic theory says player B will always accept the offer, as long as it's more than nothing. So player A knows that, so if he's allowed to split the dollars how he likes, he'll give player B the lowest he can, $1, and he'll take $9. Player B will say, shucks, $1's better than nothing. Player A gets $9, that's nothing to do with me. I want $1. So economic theory says you get a very unjust split from the dictator. Player B will accept it. Of course, in reality, how do you feel somebody decides to pocket 90% of the money and only offer you 10? A lot of the time, player B says, well, stuff you. If you're not going to be fair with me, neither of us will get any money. Hand it back to the experimenter. So this is two problems for the traditional economic model. In the dictator game, you've got complete choice over who gets how much money. Why don't people just take it all? In the ultimatum game, why does player B reject the unfair splits a lot of the time? Well, the truth is very simple. Most people like things to be fair. Whether it's a matter of they don't want to let somebody get more than their fair share, or they don't want somebody walking out of the experiment with nothing, this is a reality to which modern economic theory is blind. And if you're a psychopath, of course, you don't like things to be fair. You don't give a stuff about anyone else. You think, how do you get the most? So is that just a coincidence that that's exactly what modern economic theory predicts? Either way, it's slightly an embarrassing corner for economic theory, this behavioural economics, and a lot of people have said, oh, well, that's because you didn't explain it carefully enough to people. If they understood, then I'm sure they would have behaved more selfishly. Now, I don't buy that because it's been replicated in a lot of different studies, a lot of different cultures. And some people have said, well, these people are economically not literate. They ought to behave more selfishly. If they did, perhaps the economy would be working better, because after all, it's set up on the assumption that people aren't going to be concerned about other people. So if they are, well, that's breaking our model. So I don't know whether people have cited this as evidence that we need economic literacy. I consider that's putting the cart before the horse. Why make a model of people being selfish, then say, yeah, people don't fit this model, we better change the people. We better make them more selfish. I think, no, people have a natural tendency to try and be fair. Well, that makes a lot of sense. You're living with people. You don't want to shortchange them. You've got to treat people right, and they'll treat you right. This is understood. This is the golden rule. This is understood by all cultures everywhere. Yeah, not by psychopaths. But why do we have this economic model which seems to think this is strange behaviour? I think time for a new economic model. Now, the fourth section, subliminal effect, is a very simple experiment. The experimenter said, pull up a chair. And people did. It was a chair on wheels. And then they measured how close to the experimenter did the subject pull up his chair. Now, why was this of significance? Well, in the background, there was a computer monitor on the desk of the experimenter with one of three different screensavers showing. One was a fish tank. You've probably seen that fish swimming around. One was a blank screen. One was dollar bills animated. So, why do you think that might have affected the way that people sat? How do you think that could have changed the distance? Well, the difference between the fish screensaver and the blank screen was negligible. People sat, on average, about 31 or 32 inches away from the experimenter. The money screensaver, however, was different. People sat, on average, about 46 inches away from the experimenter. So, having money not mentioned, just in the background, people were subtly reminded that there is a thing called money. Why did those people sit nearly 50% further away from the experimenter because they were reminded of money. And the next result was even more dramatic. Having sat down, people were asked, well, we've got a choice here. You can either work with somebody else on the task we give you, or you can work on your own. Which would you rather? So how would the money screensaver be different from the other screensavers? Would people want to work together, or would they want to work alone? Well, fish screensaver, we have about 74% of people wanted to work together. The blank screensaver, 68%. The money screensaver, 18%. So there's money floating around behind the experimenter on his computer monitor, which nobody tells the experimental subjects is important. It's just visible in the background, they think by chance, but has a dramatic effect on the number of people who choose to work together. It shrinks from about 70-odd% to slightly less than 20. So why did the money screensaver make people sit further away and prefer to work alone rather than work together? Well, experimenters reported, quote, in summary, we found that small reminders of money produce large changes in behavior, unquote. So even subtle reminders of money are making people feel more independent. If you're independent, you don't want to work with other people. Maybe you think, well, they're going to have to get my money if I get a reward for doing this task. So money basically encourages competition rather than collaboration. Now this too is a problem in a world where more and more things are done for money. Do we want people to be competing with other people when they could be collaborating? I haven't got a problem with competition when it's fun. Playing football, playing cricket is fine. What about competing for things to eat? I would rather be working together on most of the problems of the world than trying to compete with other people, because they're large problems and we could do better working together. Of course, there's a small elite, call them the 1%, who want the other 99% to be competing with one another, not collaborating. We've seen endlessly on the show about divide and conquer techniques such as racism, religious wars, sexism. Seems to me that perhaps the most effective divide and conquer technique to keep people competing with other people is money. If you're a farmer, your village has a good harvest, you know everybody's going to be eating well. Unless you're in the market mechanism when you're selling the crops, in that case, you want everybody else in the village to have a bad harvest, because then you're going to get a higher price for your goods. The fifth section is called Selfishness of Economists, and it looks at some studies that have been done since the 1990s comparing economics graduates with other graduates. Embarrassingly enough, they give less money to charity, and when they're in these behavioral economics experiments, like the dictator game, the ultimatum game, they tend to behave more selfishly. So why is that, I wonder? Is it because they've been made economically literate? They've learnt that the most rational, sensible way to behave is to say, well, stuff you, I want the most for myself. Does studying economics increase selfishness? Or is it just the fact that the most selfish people are naturally attracted to the discipline of economics? Or is it a bit of both? Well, the result is still unclear. So, to summarize the five sections, economists are more selfish than non-economists. Subtle reminders of money make people behave in different ways, make them more interested to compete less interested in sharing and working together. Having lots of money reduces people's interest in friendship, and money works as a kind of social painkiller. Money doesn't always motivate people, and people, when they think about money, behave in a more selfish fashion. Economics says, well, that's because people are selfish. But research into their behavior doesn't bear this out. People are not as selfish as the economic models predict.
And remember, the slides for that are available for download from our webpage unwelcomeguest.net/599. Now, as I said, that's a compilation of research from different subject areas. If you know any other research results which you think will be of interest, I would love to hear more. It's not easy to compile this sort of stuff because I think it's a very under-researched area. A lot of grant-giving bodies don't actually want to know these results. I think they're very important for stimulating the discussion of, do we actually want to have a money system? It's hard to say exactly what's the influence of a money system on our society. I find those results quite persuasive that it has a pernicious effect, something that supports my own intuition. Now, even harder to get any kind of empirical research onto how the money system affects society, because we can't run society in a lab, we can't go back and do things differently. But for a bigger picture, we're going to conclude with an audio adaptation of a film called On Modern Servitude. This is by Jean-François Brion, and if you can find it online, I would encourage you to do that, because it's got some stimulating visuals, lots of pan widescreen shots about huge slums or sweatshop workers doing repetitive soldering or burning the beaks off chicks or other such rather shocking images of modern life. And it's got quite a lot of periods of silence where the images do the talking. And in order to preserve the character of the film, I've not cut as much silence out as I normally would. So I hope you find this a stimulating and thought-provoking reflection on the difficult topic of how money influences people in general, how it influences society, and how it's influenced you in your life.
Modern servitude is voluntary, consented to by the mass of slaves who trudge along the face of the earth. They themselves buy the commodities that enslave them every day more. Slaves procure alienating jobs that are bestowed upon the tame. They themselves choose the masters whom they will obey. For this absurd tragedy to play out, it has been necessary to breed in them the ignorance of their own exploitation and alienation. Behold, the bizarre modernity of our time, as with the slaves of antiquity, serfs of the Middle Ages, or the working class of the first industrial revolutions, today we bear witness to an emerging class of the totally enslaved. The difference being, they don't know it, or better yet, choose to ignore it. They fail to recognize the one weapon available to the enslaved, rebellion. Slaves accept without question the pitiful life that was manufactured on their behalf. Apathy and resignation are the sources of their misfortune. Behold the nightmare of the modern-day slave, whose sole aspiration is to be swept away by the macabre dance of the machine of alienation. As slaves build their world with the alienated strength of their work, the world they core becomes the jail they will be forced to inhabit, a squalid world lacking taste and scent, a host to the misery inherent in the dominant mode of production. This decor is in a state of perpetual construction. Nothing in it is constant. The ceaseless redesign of the space that surrounds us is justified by the generalized amnesia and insecurity that its inhabitants must live with. The system's objective is to fashion everything in its image. Every day the world becomes dirtier and noisier, like a factory. Every inch of land in this world belongs to a state or to an individual. This social theft through the acquisition of lands is manifested by the omnipresence of walls, fences, barriers, and frontiers. These are the visible marks of the divide that invades everything. The unification of space for commercial ends, however, is the grand objective of our sad age. The world must become an immense and efficient highway in order to facilitate the transport of merchandise. Every obstacle, human or natural, must be destroyed. The inhumane concentration of modern-day slaves into reduced, crowded spaces reflects their lives and evokes cages, jails, and caves. But in contrast to slaves or prisoners, the modern-day slave pays for his cage. In this narrow and mournful place they inhabit, slaves accumulate the commodities that, according to the omnipresent advertising, will guarantee happiness and fulfillment. Alas, the more commodities they accumulate, the more elusive happiness becomes. Commodities, ideological by nature, estranged from his work, he who produces them, and divorced from his life, he who consumes them. In the dominant economic system, demand no longer drives supply. It is supply which determines demand. New needs are periodically manufactured and hence considered essential by most people. It began with the radio, followed by the automobile, later the television set, the computer, and now the cell phone. All these commodities, massively distributed over a brief period of time, profoundly alter human relationships. They serve to isolate human beings from their fellow creatures, while at the same time they propagate the dominant messages of the system. Everything we possess will in turn possess us. It is in the way in which the modern slave feeds himself that better illustrates his degree of decay. With little time to spare for the preparation of his sustenance, he is reduced to consuming quick meals produced by the agrochemical industry. He wanders through supermarkets looking for the ersatz that the society of false abundance offers. Once again, his choice is nothing but an illusion. The abundance of food as a commodity is evidence of its degradation and falsification. It is nothing more than genetically modified organisms, a mix of colorants and preservatives, of pesticides, hormones, and other inventions of modernity. Immediate gratification is the motivation behind how a slave chooses to feed himself. This is the motivating factor for all forms of consumption. The consequences are everywhere evident. However, it is when faced with the indigence of the majority that the Westerner can rejoice in his position of privilege and frenetic consumption. As a consequence, misery is ubiquitous in a totalitarian mercantile society. Scarcity is the other face of the false abundance coin. Despite the ample supply produced by the agrochemical industry, in a system where inequality means progress, hunger must not disappear ever. The other consequence of the alleged food abundance is the multiplication of concentration factories and the massive and barbarous extermination of species for the sustenance of the enslaved. That is the essence of the dominant mode of production. Life and humankind cannot withstand the thirst for profit of a few. The pillage of the planet's resources, the massive production of energy or commodities, the waste products of the ostentatious consumption, jeopardize the possibilities of survival for our planet and the species which inhabit it. However, in order to pave the way for brutal capitalism, the growth must continue. Produce, produce, and keep producing. Those who contaminate are today misrepresenting themselves as the saviors of the planet. Those show business buffoons, sponsored by multinational firms, try to convince us that a simple change in our habits will be enough to save the planet from disaster. And while they blame us, they keep on contaminating the environment and our souls. Those poor pseudo-ecological views are repeated by corrupt politicians in need of advertising slogans. Those in charge take pains to avoid making significant change in the production system, and as always, change is half-hearted and superficial. Things remain as they are and have always been. In order to participate in the round of frenetic consumption, one must have means and one must, therefore, work. In other words, one must sell oneself. The dominant system champions work as its most esteemed value. Slaves have to work more to buy on credit their miserable lives. Slaves wear out in the workplace. They waste their vital strength and have to suffer the worst humiliations. They spend their lives performing grueling tasks for the benefit of a few. Modern unemployment is invented as a scare tactic to force slaves into endless gratitude for the generosity of the power elite. What would they do if they didn't have to suffer this torture called work? These alienating activities are touted as freeing. What degradation and what misfortune. Always pressured on by the time clock or the whip, every movement of the slave is designed to increase productivity. The scientific organization of labor is at the heart of the worker's divestment from himself, the fruit of his labor and his time, which is misspent in the automated production of commodities or services. The worker's labor is mistaken for that of the machine in the factories or the computer in the office. Paid time will never be recovered. Every worker is assigned a repetitive duty, be it physical or intellectual. The worker is a specialist in his own field. This specialization can be seen on a worldwide scale within the framework of the International Division of Labor. Conceived in the West, produced in Asia, and lethal in Africa. To the extent that the system of production colonizes every sector of life, the modern slave is manipulated into wasting his free time in leisure activities and planned holidays. No part of his life escapes the reach of the system. Every moment of his life has been invaded. He is a full-time slave. The generalized degradation of his environment, of the air he breathes, of the food that he consumes, the stress of his working environment, his entire social condition are the origins of the new diseases befalling the modern slave. His servile standing is an ill for which there will never be a cure. Only the complete emancipation from his present condition would allow the modern slave to recover from his suffering. Western medicine knows only one way to cure the maladies of the modern day slave, mutilation. Under commercial medicine, patients are subjected to surgeries, antibiotics, and chemotherapy. The origins of pain are never considered, only its consequences. For such inquiry would inevitably lead to a condemnation of the social structure in its totality. Just as the current system reduces everything in our world to mere commodities, so does it transform our bodies into such. Into the object of study and experimentation of the pseudo-wise men of commercial medicine and molecular biology. The masters of the world are set to patent every living thing. The complete sequencing of the DNA of the human genome is the point of departure of a new strategy bent on power. Genetic decoding serves no purpose but to considerably expand domination and control. As with many other things, our bodies no longer belong to us. The best part of the slave's life slips through his fingers, but he continues because he has always obeyed. Obedience has become second nature to him. He obeys, not knowing why, simply that he must. Obey, produce, and consume. Behold the triptych that rules his life. He obeys his parents, his teachers, and his masters, the landlords and the merchants. He obeys the forces of law and order. He obeys all powers because he does not know any better. There is nothing that frightens him more than disobedience. because it signifies risk, adventure, change. Just as a child panics when he loses sight of his parents, the modern slave feels lost without the power system that has created him. His obedience, therefore, continues. Fear has made us slaves, and it keeps us in that condition. We bow before the masters of the world. We accept this life of humiliations and misery strictly out of fear. Nevertheless, we count on greater numbers as compared to the ruling class. Their strength does not come from the police, it comes from our consent. We justify our cowardice to the forces that oppress us with a discourse full of moralizing humanism. The rejection of revolutionary violence is anchored in the spirit of those who oppose the system while defending the values it teaches. But when power must defend its hegemony, it never hesitates to use violence. Nonetheless, there are individuals who escape mental control, but they are under surveillance. Every uprising or act of resistance is considered deviant behavior or an act of terrorism. Freedom is reserved for those who defend the commercial interests. Henceforth, the real opposition to the dominant system is totally clandestine. For its retractors, repression is the consequence. The silence of the majority of slaves facing this repression is the result of a political and media campaign that denies the existence of this real conflict. As with all oppressed human beings throughout history, the modern slave needs mysticism and God to anesthetize the evil that torments him and the suffering that overwhelms him. But this new God to whom he gave his soul is naught but nothingness, a piece of paper, a number, that, through his common consent, acquires artificial value. It is in the name of this God that people work, study, fight, and sell themselves. It is for this God that man forsakes his values and is prepared to do whatever. He believes that the more money he possesses, the more free he will be from all constraints, as though ownership and freedom went hand in hand. But freedom is the asceticism that comes from self-control, from the desire and will to act, to be, not to have. One must resolve to never serve or obey under any condition. To be free, it is necessary to break with habits that no one, it seems, dare challenge. Today's slave is convinced that there is no alternative to the existing world order. He has resigned himself to this life because he believes there is no other. Herein lies the force of the present domination. Maintain the illusion that this system, which has colonized the entire world, is the end of history. It has convinced the subjugated class that this ideology is mankind's true state of nature and as such his logical condition. To dream a different world has become a crime condemned in unison by the media and all the entities of power. When in reality, the criminal is he who contributes, consciously or not, to the dementia of the dominant social structure. There is no greater madness than that of the present system. In light of the world's devastation, the system needs to conquer the slave's conscience. At an early age, repression takes the form of dissuasion and is used to educate slaves. They must forget their servile condition, their prisons, and their miserable lives. The sight of hypnotized masses connected to the screens that accompany them in their daily lives is proof enough. They disguise their permanent dissatisfaction with the distorted image of a dream life made of money, glory, and adventure. But their dreams are as deplorable as their miserable life. There are images for everything and for everybody. Those images constitute the ideological message of modern society and serve as means of unification and propaganda. As mankind is stripped from his world and his life, these images multiply. Children are the first target of these images. They must be made stupid, bereft of any reflective and critical thinking. All this is done with the disconcerting complicity of their parents, who have surrendered to the modern communication apparatus. They themselves buy the commodities that enslave their offspring. They abdicate their role in their children's education and entrust it to a mediocre and stultifying system. There are images for all ages and for all social classes. Modern slaves mistake those images for culture and at times for art. The market relies on the basest impulses to sell any commodity. It is women, doubly enslaved in today's society, who pay dearest. In it, she is reduced to being a mere object of consumption. The image of uprising has also been divested of its subversive potential. The image is today the simplest and most effective form of communication. It creates role models. It stultifies the masses. It lies to them, and it breeds frustrations in them. The mercantile ideology is disseminated repeatedly through the use of the image. Its objective is always the same: to sell, be it ways of life or products, behaviors or commodities. No matter what, sell. These unfortunate slaves entertain themselves, but the entertainment serves only to distract them from the ills that plague them. Slaves have left their lives in the hands of others to do whatever they will and pretend to take pride in it. They affect satisfaction, but nobody believes it. Even before the cold reflection of the mirror, they fail to fool themselves. They pilfer their time watching idiots who make them laugh, sing, dream, or cry. The sports media becomes a channel through which slaves feel the success, failure, effort, and victory they no longer experience in the flesh. They live by proxy in front of the television set. While the emperors of ancient Rome lulled their people into submission with the promise of bread and games, today's acquiescence is procured through entertainment and the consumption of emptiness. The domination of consciousness is the result of the misuse of language by the social and economic ruling class. As the masters of all means of communication, the power elite disseminate the market ideology through the fixed, partial, and concocted meaning it gives to words. Words are invoked as neutral and their definition is evident. However, when controlled by power, words fix a very different meaning to the reality of life. It is primarily a language of resignation and impotence. It is the language of passive acceptance of things as they are and should remain. Words are the lackeys of the dominant system of life. Our use of the power's language condemns us to impotence. The resolution of the language issue is at the core of the struggle for the emancipation of humankind. It is not an additional form of domination, but the heart itself of the totalitarian mercantile system's project to enslave. It is by reappropriating language and thus communication among people that the possibility of radical change arises. In this way, the revolutionary and the poetic converge. In the collective effervescence, the spoken word is reinvented by a myriad of groups. Spontaneous creativity is within us all and is a force for unity. Despite his bonds, the modern slave is convinced of his citizenship. The illusion of choice and free determination is fueled by the ability to vote and freely elect those who will conduct his affairs. When it comes down to deciding the society we want to live in, is there really any fundamental difference between the Social Democrats and the populist right in France, between Democrats and Republicans in the United States, between Labour and Conservatives in the United Kingdom? There is no opposition, because the main political parties agree on one essential thing: the conservation of the present mercantile society. None of the political parties that enter into power question the commodities dogma. And those political parties, with media complicity, monopolize the airwaves. They squabble about trite matters, ensuring the status quo. They fight over who will hold the seats that the mercantile parliamentary offers. Those petty disputes are disseminated by the media as a distraction from the critical debate about the election of the society we want to live in. Appearance and triviality eclipse the confrontation of ideas. None of this resembles, not even from afar, a democracy. Real democracy is defined, firstly, by the mass participation of citizens in the governance of community affairs. It is direct and participative. The popular assembly and the permanent dialogue about the organization of a common life are democracy's most authentic expressions. Representative and parliamentarian forms of government usurp the name of democracy, limiting the power of citizens to the simple act of voting, that is, to nothing. Deciding between light gray and dark gray is not a real election. Parliamentarian seats are mainly occupied by the dominant economic class, be it the right or the pseudo-leftist social democrats. Power is not to be conquered, it is to be destroyed. It is tyrannical by nature, whether exercised by a king, a dictator, or an elected president. The only difference with a parliamentarian democracy is that the modern slave has the illusion of choosing the master he will obey. The vote has made him an accomplice to the tyranny that oppresses him. He is not a slave because masters exist. Masters exist because he elects to remain a slave. The dominant system is defined thus by the omnipresence of its mercantile ideology. It occupies every space and every sector of life. It calls us to produce, sell, consume, and accumulate. The dominant system has reduced all human interaction to dry mercantile relationships and considers our planet a mere commodity. Our duty is to be servile. The only recognized right is the right to private property. The only god it worships is money. The right to appear is monopolized by those in power. The stage is reserved for the men and speeches that uphold the dominant ideology. Critical thinking is drowned out in a sea of media that determine what is right and what is wrong, what can and cannot be seen. The omnipresence of ideology, the worship of money, the media's bias, the absence of democratic pluralism, the lack of a visible opposition, the will to transform mankind and all the world in its image, and repression in all its forms. Behold, the true face of modern totalitarianism. The majority calls it liberal democracy. It is time to call it what it truly is, a totalitarian mercantile system. Mankind, society, and the entire planet serve this ideology. The totalitarian mercantile system has achieved what no other totalitarian system could: hegemony over the world through its ideology. Today, exile is impossible. And I oppress. So take your peace easy. Go home soon like lightning. We soon will be riding my shiny black vest. No fat rich man's pony. Well, thank you to Jean-François Pignon for making that film and giving it away to the people of the world. I am privileged to have the facilities and the time to be able to make these radio shows and give them away to the world. Now, I do occasionally meet people who think it's crazy or even selfish of me to spend so long every week making a radio show for which I don't get paid. I think it's a privilege. I love to be able to give something of significance to people, and I'm encouraged every time I read an email from an unwelcome guest listener to keep doing what I'm doing. I love the fact that I don't have a boss telling me what to do, that I can follow my heart and my conscience, and I would like to see a world in which more and more people were feeling free to do this. And this is why I regularly encourage you to give all you can, to not be happy just with making enough money to survive, but focus instead on what you can give to other people outside of the money system, outside of the hierarchically controlled, the alienated, outside of the selfish sphere. I hope this show has helped you to understand possible wider implications of doing things for free for other people. If you would like to hear it again, you can download it, as you can any of our previous episodes from the MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. If you would like to share a story of how this show has affected you, there's a discussion tab for this episode at unwelcomeguest.net/599. We have a mailing list for discussions about the show at altruists.org/unwelcome, and there's RSS feeds on the left-hand side of the webpage. Our theme music, The Unwelcome Guest, is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening, and I wish you success in getting out of wage slavery and into the world of the gift. Just like